The following is a presentation of Grace Covenant Baptist Church, West Monroe, Louisiana.
Well, today we are going to step off and wade into the deep end of the pool of the attributes of God. Well, you might want to go get them. This is an understanding of God's attributes that is quite controversial today. If you're asking any professing Christian, if you ask them about this attribute, they will say that they understand it, that they agree with it, if you're just calling it by name. That they will agree with it wholeheartedly. Absolutely, they will support this. Let me ask it this way. What attribute of God do y'all think is most controversial, particularly in terms of how other believers, even in terms, see us as good old Reformed folks? Which attribute would you pick?
Maybe.
But as Reformed folks, what do other believers think is most, as an attribute of God, is most controversial to us? Sovereignty of God, particularly in terms of salvation. But absolutely, the sovereignty. But I'd be willing to say I don't think we get to pick which areas we choose God as being sovereign in or not. So the sovereignty of God, either he is sovereign or he's not. Yeah. Well, and you make a great point. For us to be at the sovereignty of God right here, just for somewhat brevity's sake of our entire study, there's really some steps that are built prior to this one, you know, in the foreknowledge of God, the decrees of God, the foreknowledge of God, these other things that build, the supremacy of God that build up to his sovereignty. So you're right in saying that, because those things, as we talked about the very first week, every attribute describes all the other attributes. Right, there's not, you know, we can't separate this piece from that piece. I know that's how we're talking about them, but they all exist together. So, yes, all those things go together. So what is the sovereignty of God? Somebody give me what you can, a quick rundown of what that is. What does it mean? Yeah, I think it's a Sproul comment. There are no maverick molecules taken off of urgency.
I would go one step further.
Yeah.
I mean, to say that God is in control of all
which goes back to the concept of all the other attributes defining each other. You know, as we talked a few weeks ago about the solitariness of God and God being completely perfect and complete in and of himself, and all these things that were created coming from him, you know, which essentially gives him the right to be sovereign because everything having come from. So Pink says it this way, and I love this. He says, the sovereignty of God means that God is God in fact as well as in name. You know, we think God, well, God is God, but His sovereignty means that He is actually God. That in fact, in actual life, He is God is what the sovereignty of God means. The fact that He is King, that He is actively reigning and presiding, that His rule and authority transcends time, transcends space, that there is nothing outside of His scope. The idea that it's not just that He reigns, as we talked about it earlier, it's that He has the right, the full right, the only one with the right and authority to reign. The idea that God didn't take His kingship, His ruling authority by force. He didn't win it. He didn't enter a battle and take it from someone else. It has always been His. It always will be His. He is the one who reigns. Why? Because He's the one who reigns. You know, there's no debate. You know, I've heard people say it before. He's not on the election trail. He's not running for God. You know, there's none of that.
Right. They were sovereign before Him.
Right.
The next one in line.
Yeah.
No, He has always been sovereign. It is His sovereign right to be sovereign.
To be sovereign. Yeah. Yeah, there's no debate. There's no debate on it. Steve Lawson defines it this way. He says, His sovereignty is His absolute, active, continual reign over everything. His undisputed right to govern all that He has created as God by the free exercise of His supreme right rules over all with unhindered, unrivaled majesty. He is not merely passively sitting on His throne, disconnected from the world. Instead, upon His throne, He is directly governing and ruling over everything in His world. I've got a relatively long quote for Spurgeon. So it might be short or long, but relatively. Let me read this. He says, Spurgeon says, on the other hand, there is no doctrine more hated by worldlings, no truth of which they have made such a football as the great, stupendous, but yet most certain doctrine of the sovereignty of the infinite Jehovah. Men will allow God to be everywhere except on His throne. They will allow Him to be in His workshop to fashion worlds, to make stars. They will allow Him to be in His almonry to dispense His alms and bestow His bounties. They will allow Him to sustain the earth and bear up the pillars thereof, or light the lamps of heaven, or rule the waves of the ever-moving ocean. But when God ascends His throne, His creatures then gnash their teeth. And we proclaim an enthroned God and His right to do as He wills with His own, to dispose of His creatures as He thinks well, without consulting them in the matter. Then it is that we are hissed and execrated, and then it is that men turn a deaf ear to us, for God on His throne is not the God they love. But it is God upon the throne that we love to preach. It is God upon His throne whom we trust. So as he points out here, the idea of the world hating God being on His throne. He can rule in all these other areas, you know, holding the earth up, you know, rule and giving me peace, rule and dispensing blessings, all this stuff. But when He ascends the throne fully as King and reigner and ruler of all life, His creation hates it. So the question is, why do you think the doctrine of the sovereignty of God is so hated, is so combated, particularly today in our society? Particularly if it's a remote control. We really want that one. Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't fit in with that, does it? Yeah. What do you mean? Define that a little more for us. What do you mean?
Well, the American dream is amazing. They put up a bootstrap, so it's all up to you what you do and you want. And, you know, you can have the world, and all you got to do is work for it.
Yeah.
It's not a work based salvation. Once God's solved you, you're saved by grace and nothing else.
Yeah.
Now, that's probably why most people have such a difficult time talking to God, especially for those of us.
Yeah. Obviously, from the very beginning, you know, the first lie ever told, the utterance of the serpent, did God really say? You know, he was questioning the sovereignty of God from the beginning. So I don't mean to imply that this is a brand new thing. But I would say that our country, particular generations, have taken a disdain for this concept to a whole nother level. And when I was thinking about it, think about the holiday that we're just about to celebrate on Monday, July 4th. What is the nickname for July 4th? Independence Day, right? I do what I want. I mean, from the very foundation of our country, we were founded on freedom. We were founded on independence. You know, Spurgeon talks about in his quote, the idea that the enthroned God has the right to do what he wants with his creatures without consulting them. Why did we separate in the first place? Taxation without representation. We need a say in everything that our king tries to do to us. You know? I mean, like I said, from the very founding of our country, a democracy, the idea that we get a vote, we have a say in everything that we do. And one thing, I'm not saying that these things are bad. I'm just simply saying every foundational aspect of our culture, of our country, is on who we are. Look at our marketing. Your way right away. I don't know if Burger King still has that marketing. You know, have it your way right away. You know, Sprite, be you. There was a couple others I was thinking. But the idea is that we live in a culture that definitely hyper-magnifies individual choice, individual right. It's up to you. Do what you want. Anything that you want. And so it's been a problem. It's been an issue since sin was an issue. But I think that we've taken it to even higher depths, if I can use that word, of this concept. If we're honest with ourselves, we're all in that boat. Maybe just in different areas. We all want God in control. But if we're honest with ourselves, we look at certain areas of our life. I don't know if Him being in control means He's going to take this away. Maybe I don't want that. And we might know all intellectually that, okay, if that gets taken away, that it's ultimately for our good and for His glory, absolutely. But I think that there's all things that it can bring fear. And it should be comforting, but there's definitely moments of hesitation, whatever that area is. And it's some, you know, like you're talking about God's sovereignty and salvation. Some people, well, no, He's sovereign in all these other things, but not that. Not that one. Not that. We've got that one. Or, you know, He's sovereign in all things, but, you know, my businesses, I've got those. I can take care of these, you know. Or maybe we like God being in control, but we only like Him being in control when His control brings things we like. When this control brings things we don't like, we're not so much for that control. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
My experience with people in this area of sovereignty has been, everybody's okay with God being sovereign. out for one's neighbor, to not depend upon anybody else to look after you, those kinds of things. And so there's, the Christian ethic is very much, in political terms, small government, individual reliance, and responsibility. And I think Satan, as far back as the beginning days of our nation, has been working a deceit upon people to think that this country is all about independence, all about you can't tell me what I'm going to do. I don't have a king. I'm a citizen. We're a democracy. All those terms. Not necessarily for the destruction of the nation, although that's where it's going.
Right.
But for the deception of who God really is. Because even though you see the seminal seedbed of what we would call Arminianism today, throughout history, it was in England, it was in the early church, it's really got its head here in probably 18th, 19th, 20th century, 21st century era, almost throughout the history of our nation.
Yeah.
Has been this very strong self-reliance that has bled over into theology that says, no, God didn't choose me, I chose him. It's my work. It is deceiving people.
Yeah.
And our nation, society, because we have so untethered ourselves from God, it's killing us, destroying us. Those two things, the point was, is, the politics and society must be tied to theology. They are tied to theology.
Right. Exactly.
All that is intimately tied together.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Spurgeon says that there's nothing for which the children ought more earnestly to contend than the doctrine of their master being over all creation. Steve Lawson says that the sovereignty of God is the foundational truth of all Christianity. How could we see these statements as being true? Why do we think these statements would be true? The fact that there's, as Spurgeon says, there's nothing we should contend for more than God's sovereignty. As Steve Voss says, it's the foundational truth of all Christianity. But put a couple seconds thought into that, and why do you think those statements would be true? Why is this so important? Okay, why would that be? No.
Because if God's not sovereign, somebody else is.
Mm-mm.
There must be a sovereign.
Gotta be.
In our way of thinking, where we believe it's kind of a modern, postmodern concept that the community makes decisions for itself. We kind of just fit into this idea that somebody's in charge.
Yeah.
That everybody's in charge. And that's why nothing is done anymore.
Yeah.
But if somebody's sovereign,
yeah,
there is a single person in charge of everything. And if God is not it, then somebody else is.
Yep. Yeah, and if everything we understand about our entire belief, faith, world comes from God, His promises, His curses, the blessings, the commandments, teachings. Can He even fulfill His promises if He's not sovereign? He can't, because therefore someone else is, or something else is. If something else is, then He doesn't have the ability to fulfill the promises that He's given us. The question of why should I listen to God? Who is God to tell me anything? Why do I have to do? Where does His authority come from? That is answered in the sovereignty of God. And without that, everything else that He says and does, one, can't really be trusted. Two, doesn't have to be obeyed because He is not sovereign. So this foundational truth leads to everything else in our understanding of who we are and who God is wrapped up in His right to rule and reign over everything He's created. R.C. Sproul has a quote. I love this, and I think he says it somewhat tongue in cheek, but it's truly, I like it. He says, "The doctrine of the sovereignty of God is God's favorite doctrine, and it would be your favorite doctrine if you were God also." I like it. Well, it's time. Let's see what the Bible has to say about this, because the Bible is not unclear or silent in any way when it comes to God's sovereignty. It's declared pretty forcefully and extremely clearly. Psalm 103:19 says, "The Lord has established His throne in the heavens. His sovereignty rules over all." So the passage that we're going to be primarily in, don't turn there yet, is going to be in Psalm 33. But we're going to start over here in Psalm 93. So as y'all are turning to Psalm 93, here's some dictionary definitions of sovereignty. Above or superior to all others. Chief, greatest, supreme, supreme in power, rank and authority, holding the position of ruler, royalty, reigning, independent of all others. I think that defines sovereignty very well. So if you're at Psalm 93, Psalm 93 through Psalm 99 are a collection of hymns of praise to God, specifically for His divine kingship. Some have called them the enthronement psalms, because repeated through these chapters is a phrase, "The Lord reigns," as the psalmist is praising God. It starts off here in Psalm 93, verse 1. "The Lord reigns. He is robed in majesty. The Lord is robed. He has put on strength as His belt. Yes, the world is established. It shall never be moved." 93. In 96... 96 verse 10. Once again, "Say among the nations, the Lord reigns. Yes, the world is established. It shall never be moved. He will judge the peoples with equity." Somebody read for us 97 verse 1. Once again, "The Lord reigns." Chapter 99, verse 1. Somebody read that one for us. "The Lord reigns." Now, children, let me ask you all this question. God reigning means that He's in control. He's ruling all things. So if God reigns and He is in control, all right, children, who does this mean doesn't reign? Who does this mean is not in control? If God reigns and He's in control, who's not? We are not. Excellent. Who else is not in control if we are? Satan is not, right? So what this means is that God is sovereign over His enemies as well. Satan. Us, as we are described in Scripture, outside of Christ. Yeah. We've been reading Job at home, and it's, the sons of God, angels, come present themselves before God, and Satan comes along too. There's so many in our world that are so fearful of Satan. And not that there is not something to be filled. In and of ourselves, He has more power than we do, obviously. But if God is reigning, Satan is not. They are not these equal. There's no duel. Yeah. I mean, the angels come present themselves before God. Satan comes along with them, and I almost picture him, you know, he kind of, well, yeah, but if you didn't give this guy so much, you know, it's like this kind of complaining kind of thing. You know, he's not saying, I will do this to your servant Job. You know, he points something out, you know, as God brings up Job, and God in his sovereign ordination says, go and do, and commands even him, you know, allows even him. But the idea is that, you know, nothing is compared to our God. Go ahead.
You're messing up the democracy with salvation. How many times have you heard the evangelist or even the pastor? God voted for you, yeah. Satan voted against you. You make the decided vote whether or not you're going to heaven or not.
Yeah.
It's messing all that up. That's a great illustration.
Yeah,
it's certainly a much used illustration.
But there is no democracy in heaven. And the sovereignty of God, it is not a democracy. This is not even a constitutional representative republic. It is a theocracy, yeah. With one head. Absolutely.
In the early days of our church, that they got me in trouble. Because there was kind of a common thought that all the decisions of our church were is a democracy. We all voted on, you know, what our church does. And in logistics, okay, I'm fine with that. But it had rolled over to theological considerations. And I said, our church is not a democracy. Our church is a theocracy. God tells us what.
God tells us.
I
can't imagine it would have. Yeah. You're right. Yeah. So who else? Okay, Satan's not in control. We're not in control. What else is not in control that in our society that gets put up there as if it's controlling things? What else?
Fate.
Tell us what you mean by that. That's a big one.
Destiny.
Absolutely.
You know, things are not on a predetermined path in and of themselves.
Yeah.
That somebody is actually taking history, human existence.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you watch any sort of high school romance movie, there's going to be some description of fate or destiny or something like that that is guided two souls together, you know. Very common. Very common.
My favorite movie is,
say,
A Touch of Destiny.
A Touch of Destiny. Okay. What about politicians? Are they in control or ruling?
Praise God, no.
I think they are. And that's very timely to what we're going through today. You know, we had this discussion two nights ago, which will flow into responsibility and sovereignty. We are still allowed the privilege and the right in some capacity to elect, to be have a hand in who our politicians are. But at the end of the day, God is still sovereign over who a president is, who a king is, who a ruler is, who a boss is, who whatever it is. God is sovereign over those things. And they are not. What about our circumstances? You know, so you hear a lot of people in life, you know, if this thing happened to me and if that wouldn't have happened, I'd have had this, 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 and this. And that one event right there caused everything to go wrong. And there's almost a feeling of that event, that circumstance, who you were, what family you were born into, what a boss did to you one time 20 years ago, what a teacher did, what a car accident that happened, that these circumstances in life, everything else that happens was caused by this one thing. And I think there's a feeling that maybe circumstances are sovereign in our life.
The greatest book I've ever heard about circumstances being sovereign in God's life. When I lived in Acton, Sam Walford was found a Walmart in the sky, just before Walmart. Fishman and I were at Walmart, and all that was a full business partner. I think I looked at Sam Walford and said, it's crazy, that would never work again. And so this guy spent a part of the rest of his life.
Right. Yeah. But that's the concept is that there's no accidents. There's no randomness. There's no fate. There's no occurrences. You know, the point here is that our future does not rest in the hands of humans. It does not rest in the hands of Lady Luck or any of these other things. God is actively directing our lives according to His purposes. Proverbs 21:1 says, "The heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord. As rivers of water, He channels it whichever way He wills." Yeah.
You know, blessings come from Him. They're not so willing to accept that those difficulties come from the hand of the Lord as well.
Absolutely.
The Puritans in the old time is called hard providences.
Yeah.
I heard a number of years ago when R.C. Junior's wife died, I heard he had a wonderful discussion about hard providences. That those things that we like, we acknowledge from the hand of God. But those things that we find painful and difficult and downright hurtful come from the hand of God as well.
Yeah.
Now, it comes from a good God for our own good, but we don't like them in the moment. I think a lot of consternation and difficulty in the lives of church folks come from an inconsistency that we see God as being the bestower of good things, but not the sovereign bestower of bad things.
Yeah.
It falls under the heading of, you know, God's not the author of sin. But we define bad things as being sinful or evil.
Right.
And really, they're not, may not be sinful or evil at all. That's right.
That's why ultimately this concept of God being sovereign should be extremely comforting to us. Spurgeon has a quote. He says, "There is no attribute more comforting to His children than that of God's sovereignty. Under the most adverse circumstances, in the most severe trials, they believe that sovereignty has ordained their afflictions, that sovereignty overrules them, and that sovereignty will sanctify them all." Amen.
So, yeah, sovereignty was biblically, historically, theologically, was given as an encouragement to the church.
Yeah.
And again, here we go again, the perversion of a blessed doctrine that was intended to give hope and comfort to God's people has been turned into a dividing point.
Yeah.
Among God's people.
Absolutely. I think something that's important to notice, that last verse we read in Psalm 99, verse 1. What tense, past, present, and future, is the phrase, "the Lord reigns"? Is that past, present, or future? It's present. Why does it matter that it is in present tense? Sure.
Well, it speaks to the eternality of God.
Okay.
God didn't just reign yesterday. He's not just going to reign tomorrow. He reigns. So it literally is a description of His reign outside of time.
Absolutely.
It's just a simple statement of fact. He reigns.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not as if God reigned in the Old Testament, and back when Israel was a theocracy prior to getting a king and all this stuff. Well, He reigned then. Not so much now. It's not as if we look at Revelation and we see the great white throne of judgment and we see Christ returning and doing these things. Well, God, He's going to reign then. And believe me, absolutely, He is going to reign then. And I would say that our understanding of His sovereignty will be much greater on that day. But this verse, "the Lord reigns," in present tense, has the sense that every time this verse is read, it is a testimony, a clear statement that God is presently reigning now. Whether this verse is read 100 years from now, 1,000 years ago, whenever it is read, it is a statement of fact, as Pastor Rusty said, outside of time, that God reigns now, whenever it is read. So, God's sovereignty is carried out in three basic areas we're going to go through. The first area, creation. Children, who can tell me Genesis 1:1? Can Asher say Genesis 1:1 for us? I don't know. What did Asher say? 1:1:2 this morning. What about you, Noah? Can you say it? It's a good verse, but that's not Genesis 1:1. That's right. God created, right? And just a couple of verses later, who is the one that says, "Let there be light"? Who says that? God says. And what happens after he says, "Let there be light"? Does it stay dark? It turns to light. Why does it turn to light? Because God made it turn to light, right? Just says it and it does it, right? Yes, no? That's an easy verse? All right, good. I'm glad to hear. Maybe one day you can explain it to all of us. All right, buddy. God creating the world, creating light, creating everything in it is an exercise of his free and sovereign will. As I mentioned a minute ago, turn over with me to Psalm 33. Psalm 33. We're going to be in verse 6. If someone can read for us verses 6 through 9 of Psalm 33. So what is being highlighted here in the ordination of God? Him being sovereign over what we just talked about? Creation. Is there anything that's really not represented in this passage that God created? You see here in verse 6, the heavens were made. Verse 6, the heavenly beings, all their host. The waters in verse 7. We see the land in verse 8, let the earth. We see in verse 8, let the inhabitants of the world, the earth creatures. So we have heavens, heavenly beings, water, land, all the creatures of the earth. Everything created by God. The idea that the moon and the earth did not self-create. You and I did not self-create. God did this with no one's help. And not that he just did it with no one's help. No one was there to help. I mean, he was God. Once again, the solitariness we talked about in and of himself created all this. So God is sovereign in creation. Now, second area, God is sovereign. Oh, yes, ma'am? What an excellent question. Who would like to answer little Ava Grace's question? Not you, Noah. She said, how did they get the book of Genesis in the Bible if no one was there to see God do these things? It's a great question.
Made all the things as Adam and Eve were walking in the garden and
So remember, God would walk with Adam in the garden. And I can imagine Adam had a lot of questions. What is all this stuff? And I bet God had a lot of answers that he gave him. Yeah. Yeah, that's a tree. Absolutely. Where were you? Yeah. So God being sovereign over all of history, he didn't just create everything and back away and let it play out, you know, as some have been known to say. You know, got the ball rolling and then, you know, we carried it on. And he moved on. Somebody read for us in Psalm 33, read verses 10 through 12. This section is really talking about God's sovereignty over history. You know, he brings the counsel of nations to nothing. He frustrates the plans of peoples. The counsel of the Lord stands forever. The plans of his heart for all generations. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord of people whom he has chosen as his heritage. This is about people. This is about our plans. This is about our history. It's about our world that he's sovereign over. A couple of quick quotes here on this idea of God being sovereign over history, over events. Steve Lawson says this: think of it this way. Not only did God create the stage of the universe, but God has prescripted the entire plot for what will take place on the stage of the universe, and it is God who is directing all the participants who are on that stage. If we're not comfortable with Steve Lawson's quote, we'll go to Calvin's. Calvin says, all of the universe is but a theater to display the glory of God. We've all heard this before, but history is really his story. God's story. God's ordination of his events, as it talks about in Daniel. God sets up kings and deposes them. He takes the heart of the king and turns it where he will. Affirm it. Absolutely. Absolutely. Isaiah chapter 46. It says this. It says, remember this and stand firm. Recall it to mind, you transgressors. Remember the former things of old. You know, we obviously know in Hebrew, there, you know, it said three times here. In other words, he's saying, pay attention. This is very important. He says, for I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is none like me. Declaring the end from the beginning, from the ancient times to things not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand and I will accomplish my purpose. I love this because the very beginning when he says to them, remember this, recall this to mind, remember these things. God knows us so well because he created us. He's saying right there, you are going to forget this. There is a time that you will forget these things. These truths will not be taught. Remember these things. And then he sets the entire parameters for everything he's about to say. Because he says, for I am God, there is no other. I am God, there is none like me. He's setting the stage and the basis that what I'm about to say, this is where this comes from. It comes from the fact that I am God. His authority. And then he says, I declare the end from the beginning, the ancient times to the things not yet done. It's as if everything, it's not that he's looking down the corridors of time and seeing what's going to happen and telling you those things are going to happen. No, as Pastor said, as he is outside of time, he sees everything that is flowing from his creation. And he's saying, this is what's going to be done. And then in the very end here, he says, my counsel will stand, I will accomplish my purpose. This is not a God that's wringing his hands and hoping and wishing. You know, it's not the idea of, you know, we lick our finger and put it up to the wind, which way is the wind blowing? God is not doing that. God is determining these things for us, for the history of the world. And he does this, as we know from Romans 8:28, he does this for his own glory and ultimately for the good of his people. Now, what God is easier to trust and believe in? The God that's which way is the wind blowing and hoping that things happen, or the God that is firm, immovable, a mighty fortress? Which God is easier to trust in? A mighty fortress is our God. Absolutely. Third area, God is sovereign in salvation. And obviously we don't have enough time left on earth to unpack this concept. But real quick, staying in Psalm 33. I said, just in this one psalm, we see God being sovereign over creation, God being sovereign over history. Go to verse 19 through 20. We'll start in 18. Behold, the eye of the Lord is on those who fear him, on those who hope in his steadfast love, that he may deliver their soul from death and keep them alive in famine. Our soul waits for the Lord. He is our help and our shield. Who delivers our soul from death? Who keeps us alive in famine? God does. He does it. He is sovereign of this. And he predestines his people for salvation based on his eternal purposes. Now the question is, was he under any obligation to deliver souls from death, to aid anyone, as it says here in Psalm 33? What do you think? Did he have to do this? What do you think, children? Did God have to save people? You don't think so? Why not? Why did he not have to? What, buddy? He didn't have to if he didn't want to, but he wanted to, right? Right? So God chose to save people, right? Did he need to save people? No, he didn't. As we talked about a few, he was perfect in and of himself, right? Absolutely. And wrapping up, what a loving truth that is. That God didn't have to choose anyone. It says in Ephesians that he predestined us as sons through Jesus Christ himself. And he did this according to the kindness of his own will. This whole time we've been talking about God being sovereign, him being king, him being reigning over all of us and all of history. This highlights the very fact that he is a loving, gracious, kind, merciful monarch, king that we serve. God is sovereign and there is no other. He is king over all the earth, but he's a king that we can trust. And he's a king that is merciful, gracious, and loving. So, with that, we will wrap it up and get back together in a few minutes. Can you turn this off for me, sister?